Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week, we'll discuss the Food for Peace program, trade, and meatpacking consolidation with Kansas Senator Jerry Moran. But first, here are this week's headlines. President Trump reassured ethanol advocates of his support for year-round E15 this week. During remarks in the nation's top corn and ethanol-producing state of Iowa, Trump said he's trusting House Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune to find a deal that works for farmers, consumers, and oil companies, including small and mid-sized refiners. He said Republican leaders are working on it and are very close to getting it done. A measure to allow year-round sales of the higher ethanol blend fuel was left out of a funding bill last week. A Rural Domestic Energy Council was established to submit a legislative proposal with the goal of considering the bill by February 25th. The provision is unlikely to pass as a standalone bill. It's unclear if it could ride on another measure, making the future of year-round E15 uncertain. The White House has completed a review of the Clean Fuel Production Tax Credit, signaling that it could be released publicly at any time. Also known as 45Z, the incentive originated in the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act during the then Biden administration and was overhauled last summer in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act tax law. Years of uncertainty over how 45Z would work, in addition to lower than expected biofuel blending rules under the renewable fuel standard, dealt a heavy blow to some biofuel producers, especially those making soy-based diesel. USDA is making its first commitment for purchasing farm commodities for food aid since temporarily taking over management of the Food for Peace program. The department is purchasing more than 200,000 tons of commodities that will be distributed through the World Food Program. AgriPulse reported earlier this month that the department had assumed management of Food for Peace from the State Department as part of an interagency agreement signed in December. There's been considerable uncertainty about the future of the Food for Peace program since the U.S. Agency for International Development was abolished last year. The Food for Peace program originated in Kansas and greatly benefits the state's growers. We asked Senator Jerry Moran about why the program's move to USDA is important.
Well, you know, we're having this conversation at a really important time. The first opportunity for the Department of Agriculture to help feed hungry people around the globe, help farmers in the United States with those opportunities to export, in a sense, the commodities that are utilized in the Food for Peace program. And I mean, the reason it's important is, I mean, farmers participate in a very noble profession, and that is feeding the world. And a lot of the world is very hungry in the United States and around the globe. And so there's a sense of satisfaction that really comes to farmers when they have the opportunity to feed people who otherwise would go to bed without a meal. And so there's a moral component to this issue. But as things are as difficult as they are in agriculture for producers across the country, the opportunity to meet that moral demand is also an opportunity for those commodities to be consumed. Several years ago, in traveling in Kansas, I was in Kensington, went down Railroad Street by the grain elevator, and grain sorghum was piled so high on the ground, you couldn't see the top of the elevator. And I've shown that photo time and time again to folks originally at USAID, to the president, to the Secretary of Agriculture in past years. And we've used that with the trade representative as well, demonstrating that the commodities are there. And at a time in which people are hungry, we ought to be using something that's sitting on the ground in Kansas and across the country to feed a hungry world. And agriculture producers, the economics, as we know, are, in my view, as bad as I can remember them being, with high input costs and low commodity prices. It also is helpful to have that grain consumed and taken off the ground and put into people's stomachs.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, the excess commodities, especially now, the economic state of farm country. But, you know, this Food for Peace program really has strong roots that tie back to Kansas, a long history of the program. Can you tell us a bit more about that history?
I'm so glad you know that. I mean, this program started in Cheyenne County, Kansas. It's our county that is the closest to Colorado and Nebraska in the far northwest corner of our state. And a Farm Bureau county meeting, some farmer brought the idea, like, we've got these commodities, why don't we use them to feed the world? One of those handwritten things on a napkin that ultimately became law as a result of members of Congress, of President Eisenhower, a Kansan, was the president at the time. And over the years, it's been hugely supported by my predecessors, particularly Senator Dole, And so it has Kansas roots, and we're proud of Kansans thinking of ways to make the world a better place and to take care of agriculture in our own state and around the globe.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the program moving over. The U.S. Agency for International Development oversaw the distribution of food aid for years before the Trump administration abolished the agency, and USAID had a large staff spread across the world that was really responsible for making sure that the food got where it was supposed to go. You know, do you think that USDA has enough people on the job throughout the world here in D.C., you know, to make sure that the food reaches the people that need it?
I'm an ag appropriator, appropriate money for the Department of Agriculture. Senator Hovind is the chairman of that subcommittee, and he is a sponsor of the legislation. So we have great support for this idea of, if we're going to do away with USAID, if the administration is not going to utilize USAID, then let's find a place that has a commitment to making sure that happens, and maybe with less bureaucracy and the other challenges that sometimes comes with USAID. And so in this case, Secretary Rollins and the department are fully accepting, fully supporting the idea that this program be brought to them. In fact, I'm really pleased with the fact that this agreement was made between the State Department and USDA. And within a matter of just a few days, they're really ready to go. Everything that I've been told is that the personnel are there. And I guess one of the things that I'd highlight is the food aid is actually administered by not-for-profit organizations, non-governmental entities, the World Food Program and others. And so a lot of the implementation and execution of Food for Peace will be done by people in the outside sector, outside government. We just need to make sure we have the right people with the right number of people to make it work within the Department of Agriculture, and we're committed to doing that.
Yeah, and you mentioned that this, you know, also would need to move through the Senate Ag Appropriations Subcommittee. You mentioned Senator Hovind, but are you confident that there's enough support for the program that it could move through there? And you also mentioned the Farm Bill that, you know, Chairman Thompson on the House Ag Committee could make some headway there.
It'd be a really great development, because what's missing, and certainly the oversight that we'll continue to do, make sure the personnel are adequate. But what's missing legislatively is the legislation that that I introduced with Congressman Mann, one of my successors in the House of Representatives in the First District of Kansas. And what's missing is that legislation becoming law, to make it permanent, to put it in statute, that what has happened with this transfer between two departments becomes permanent and legal, the law. And so the best scenario that I can see that can happen for that to become law is for it to be included in the Farm Bill when the House marks up their Farm Bill. The chairman, as we said, is supportive of that. And I've discovered in my interest in this topic that there is broad support. Sometimes there's, you know, a criticism of foreign aid by constituents, by people within our country. But when it comes to food for peace, food aid, there's just a lot of support. It makes a lot of sense to people.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after this.
As a cooperative, our customers are our owners. They share our profits and help guide our business. We're not just another lender. We're Farm Credit, and we're here for you.
Some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources. This
is my sustainability story.
A provision to allow year-round sales of E15 was left out of the recent government spending package. We asked Kansas Senator Jerry Moran if he thinks it could gain momentum to pass in the future.
Well, I've been a supporter of ethanol for decades now. My interest came when, in another day, another time, agriculture was struggling and we were looking for more markets. While we just talked about food aid and global assistance, another way that we can consume what we grow and produce in the United States is by renewable fuels. And there's lots of advantages to renewable fuels beyond just that. And E15 is a way to increase the utilization of the ethanol that we produce, increase the demand, and therefore benefit farmers in a value-added way, particularly to rural states like mine, where ethanol is something that we grow the crop to produce, and we have the ethanol plants to produce it. That's really good for the economy. And we've had a challenge. I mean, E15 has become the latest necessity, the latest insistence on our part to get something going on behalf of farmers and renewable fuel arena. And we were all hoping that this would be included in legislation that was going to pass just a few days ago in the House. It didn't happen. This is at the moment a House issue where the Speaker has appointed a committee to try to resolve the differences. And of course, the challenge in the politics of this issue is oil producing states and their members of Congress have a different view about the value of ethanol. And we also have a refining industry. We have oil and gas in Kansas. We have refineries in Kansas. We want to find something that, you know, is beneficial to the broad sector of rural economies.
The Trump administration is also focusing on consolidation in the meat packing sector. You know, there are some very big packers in Kansas. Do you think that they need to be broken up?
You know, I think the problem that we face today, and rightfully so, we need to focus on the price of people, the cost of living, what's become affordability, the word. But when it comes to meat, and meat is at a high price, people consider it high in comparison to the past. But the challenges that we have is that the meat supply is minimized. And the packers are losing money because there's not a supply of cattle. And in fact, drovers indicated it's $200 a head loss in packing. And so I think the issue, we always want competition. The free market system works best whenever there's competition. And I would suggest that but the challenge here is really that we need to increase the supply of cattle, which is low, historically low, 75-year low based upon the drought that we've had and input cost associated. So it's just been not profitable in the past. Now our cattlemen are doing a little bit better, but that still means that there's a shortage of cattle to be slaughtered and produced and put into this supply chain.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Honecke looks at China's soybean purchases from the U.S. in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
After a meeting between Presidents Trump and Xi in October, China committed to buying at least 12 million metric tons of U.S. soybeans in the final 2 months of last year and a further 25 million tons both this year and next year. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says that deadline for the 12 million metric tons is the end of February. Reuters and Bloomberg reporters based in Asia say Chinese traders think they've hit the 12 million ton mark already, and analysts tell AgriPulse that certainly could be possible. This chart tracks the amount of soybeans China has purchased from the U.S. since the end of October. China has confirmed buying 9.4 million metric tons of soybeans so far. 3.4 million metric tons are reported as going to unknown destinations. Those are soybean sales where USDA says a large portion of those are likely destined for China. China typically buys around half of all U.S. soybean exports. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Honecke.
Don't miss the must-attend Ag Policy event of the year. Register now for the 2026 AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit. Hear directly from the leaders shaping the future of agriculture as they explore innovative ideas to strengthen rural economies and guide policy decisions for the year ahead and beyond. The summit takes place March 23rd at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., with a virtual option available. View the agenda and register today at agripulse.com under the Events tab.
I was kind of known as the sheep guy around here. The fire went from north to south and it blew that way and it went straight down the house. Lost all of our sheep literally a week before we start lambing. And I was really in a bad place. I happened to notice this farm state of mind piece of paper. And I picked up my cell phone and I made a phone call, and that was the best phone call in my life. I'm glad that I'm still here. So don't do something permanent over a temporary situation.
Welcome back. The Food for Peace program, which drives demand for U.S. commodities to be used as international food aid, has been moved to USDA. We're joined by Kim Cooper with the North American Millers Association and Dalton Henry with the U.S. Wheat Associates on our panel this week. To begin, Kim, what's the impact of the decision to keep the Food for Peace program and relocate it to USDA?
It's the impact can't be overstated. I mean, the program was essentially not operating for the last year or so, and so this revival of it is very needed and very welcome, not only to farmers, millers, mariners here in the U.S., but to the millions of people abroad that depend on this program. And so having it move to USDA and having USDA move with such force and so quickly to start getting commodities out the door to feed those starving people is just, couldn't have asked for anything better. And it's exactly what we expected of them. It's why we've been pushing for USDA to have control of this program. And so we are very pleased with how things are rolling out from USDA right now.
And USDA made the first purchase commitments for the Food for Peace program this week. You know, what's the impact of this milestone after the program was potentially could have been shuttered when the U.S. Agency for International Development, you know, closed last year?
I think probably more than anything else, this initial batch of funding that's been announced in this initial set of seven countries that USDA is focused on is a real shot of confidence, both for commodity groups like U.S. Wheat Associates to see that USDA is committed to the program, that the U.S. government is committed to the program after we had a little bit of a pause, and also to you're kind of that NGO and feeding community to see that the U.S. will continue to be a leader in global food security, whether that's on commercial terms or in emergency feeding programs. And so we're excited to see follow-up and additional purchases, right? We understand that this agreement between Department of State and USDA to operate the program, right, is going to run through the end of at least this fiscal year. And so this should be the first of multiple purchases, and we'll really get to see USDA flex kind of their agricultural muscle into this program and bring a fair bit of their expertise to bear.
Yeah, and you mentioned USDA can operate the program because of that interagency agreement through the end of the fiscal year. I mean, how confident are you that, you know, the needed legislation will pass to make the program permanently at USDA?
I think we're very confident, particularly, and one of the really nice things that we get with this interagency agreement is almost a trial period, right? We've all, those of us that have worked with USDA in-kind feeding programs in the past, whether that's the McGovern-Dole School Feeding Program or that's Food for Progress programs, right? USDA was already doing the purchasing and they were running programming for other in-kind donational programs. And so for those of us that are familiar with that, we've always been confident in USDA's ability to do it. Now the rest of the world, the rest of the U.S. government and members of Congress will get a trial period here to see how USDA can do it, see that they can do it well, see that we can have positive results both for U.S. farmers and for hungry people around the world.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after this.
I think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources. This
is my sustainability story.
America never stops. Thanks to the financial support of Farm Credit, neither do the farmers and ranchers who call her home. Since the beginning, we've been helping rural America show the world what hard work can achieve. But the job is far from over. And as rural America grows further, we'll be there.
Welcome back. Moving the Food for Peace program to USDA also provides an opportunity for improvement with new leadership. We asked Kim Cooper with the North American Millers Association what the conversations with USDA have been like and how she sees the program improving.
Yeah, USDA has been great. So within a couple of weeks of the interagency agreement being signed, they were hosting roundtables where they brought in the stakeholders that care about these programs, particularly Food for Peace, to talk about how to run the program more efficiently and effectively, and making sure that we're really squeezing every ounce of dollars we've we get from Congress to make sure that we're feeding as many hungry people as possible. So the fact that they're already hosting those roundtables, they're already listening to stakeholders about how they can do things better, whether that's, you know, efficiencies on the shipping side, combining, you know, food for progress cargoes with food for peace cargoes, saving lots of money there, making, you know, the cadence of buying commodities more regular so that, you know, our millers can have an understanding of when the government is going to need those commodities, those milled products from them. I think they're open to all of those ideas, and the fact that they solicited them from us is a great starting point. So we're very hopeful that the program is going to be run in a much more efficient and effective way, that we get to feed more people with the same amount of money.
Yeah, and as we wrap up here, a question for you both. Kim, we'll start with you, but some opponents of the program have, you know, been concerned that USDA might not have the staff to facilitate it. You know, are you confident that USDA has the staff, particularly overseas, to make sure that the food aid goes to those who need it most?
Yeah, I think there's a common misconception that there are folks on the ground that are operating this program outside of the NGOs. The way that it has historically worked, and I confirmed this when I was on the ground in Kenya in September with World Food Program, World Vision, Catholic Relief Services, that it's really those organizations, those types of organizations, the NGOs that are getting it, or the shipping companies, you know, from the port to the feeding camp to the hungry people. So, you know, listen, USDA has got their Foreign Ag Service on the ground, so they're there when they're needed, but they obviously have the capacity to run this program. They run, as Dalton said, all of our other in-kind food aid programs. So they are well positioned to be doing this. They do plan to staff up to run this program as best that they can. But the fact that they're already announcing this major purchase of commodities before they even staff up to that level gives me an extreme amount of confidence that they know exactly what they're doing. And they know that they do not want to fail at this. They want to make sure that this program survives another 70 years.
I think for me, it highlights the commitment that political leaders at USDA have made to the programs, right? And to the point that Kim has made, that even though they haven't had the opportunity to staff up yet, and even though they've had, you know, the program, interagency agreement signed for, 30 days now, they've been running the program and have already turned out, you know, nearly $500 million in funding and purchase of really a significant amount of commodities, highlights to me that they've made it a priority. And that's credit to Secretary Rollins and Undersecretary Lindbergh. And when it's made a priority, it's clear that staff resources and time has followed that. And so it's not a concern that we have about whether or not they can run it. You know, can we always expand? And when they do have the opportunity to staff up, does it allow that program to maybe get a little bit more creative in how it connects U.S. producers and products that they grow to overseas markets and hungry folks? Certainly. But they've shown so far with remarkable speed that they're able to do this, and that it is a priority for them to make that happen on behalf of U.S. farmers.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Hunneke looks at the change in certified H-2A positions across the U.S. in this week's Map It Out.
The H-2A visa program is a critical source of employees for American agriculture, and the number of certified H-2A positions continues to grow in most states. This map shows both the gains and losses of certified H-2A positions across the country, from fiscal 2025, which ended last September, compared to fiscal 2024. According to the American Farm Bureau Federation, there were gains of more than 10% in states like Florida, North and South Dakota, Texas, and New Mexico. On the other hand, there were losses in Iowa, along the West Coast, and the southeastern part of the country, except for Florida. The total number of certified positions increased by more than 13,000 workers to nearly 400,000, which is about a 3.5% increase from the year before. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Hunneke.
Don't miss the must-attend Ag Policy event of the year. Register now for the 2026 AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit. Hear directly from the leaders shaping the future of agriculture as they explore innovative ideas to strengthen rural economies and guide policy decisions for the year ahead and beyond. The summit takes place March 23rd at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., with a virtual option available. View the agenda and register today at agripulse.com under the Events tab.
I was kind of known as the sheep guy around here. The fire went from north to south, and it blew that way, and it went straight down the house. lost all of our sheep literally a week before we were to start lambing. And I was really in a bad place. I happened to notice this farm state of mind piece of paper. And I picked up my cell phone and I made a phone call, and that was the best phone call in my life. I'm glad that I'm still here. So don't do something permanent over a temporary situation.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Next week, we'll bring you a special edition of the show from CattleCon, the cattle industry's annual convention in Nashville. Both the House and Senate will be in session. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.